Taking it off here, boss.
Yeah, take it off there.
Wiping it off here, boss.
Alright, wipe it off there.
Promoting Spark Plug Coffee here, boss.
Promote Spark Plug Coffee there.
You know that the secret to the best cup of coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans, but most coffee you get, even premium brands, will fail to communicate when their coffee was roasted. So it could be stale before you even bring it home. Spark Plug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-caf. But what makes Spark Plug Coffee special is that they deliver this delicious coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's guaranteed fresh and at its peak flavor. Spark Plug even offers autopilot set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never pay for the crime of forgetfulness. So, what are you waiting for? It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey, mullet heads, and multiple thank yous for downloading the Next 100 Project, the podcast that creeps into your life on Mondays and gabs about classic motion picks. Spoilers, they are ahead. I'm the sadistic jailer, Ryan Ellis, and here's the drunkard who gets a jolly out of destroying innocent public property. She's also my wife, and she's Bev.
That's me.
You drunkard. Stop wrecking innocent parking meters.
Oh, as if you care.
Stick it to the man.
About parking meters.
Oh, yeah. I hate parking and paying for it. All right. The coming attraction trivia for this week's picture. Cool Hand Luke. What we've got here is failure to communicate. Was 11th on the AFI's Top 100 Quotes list. Although I think it should have been in the top 10. The line was made famous by Strother Martin, but was later repeated by Paul Newman. But it is Strother Martin's line everyone always quotes. How many of the AFI's top 10 quotes were said by supporting players like Strother Martin, but not the top billed actor?
There were three. Number 8, May the Force Be With You, was uttered by Han Solo. Not even Obi-Wan. Did Obi-Wan ever say it?
The Force will be with you. Always.
Okay.
That's what he says.
So Han Solo, not top billed.
Yes, and I double-checked the credits online. It does say Mark Hamill, Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher, so Hamill is top bill. You're correct.
And fair, I mean, Luke Skywalker is absolutely the star of that.
I just thought maybe Ford would be top bill, so I had to double-check that one.
Number 7, All Right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up, said by Nora Desmond, who could have been top bill, but William Holden is top bill, not Gloria Swanson.
I figured it would be her and not Holden, but indeed it is Holden.
Yeah. Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, came in at number 1, uttered by Rhett Butler, played by Clark Gable.
Oh, so Vivian Leigh's top bill in the movie?
Oh, you know what? I didn't even check. She's just so obviously the star. I assume that she was.
I don't think that's true. I think he is.
What? Controversy. That is controversial. That's stupid. He's in like a third of the screen time she has.
He was the bigger name.
So what? She's clearly the star of the film.
Look how many movies have the bigger name as the top-billed actor. Look at Marlon Brando in Superman and Apocalypse Now. He's barely in either one of those movies, and yet he's the number one actor.
Yeah, speaking of Marlon Brando, I didn't even check if he was top-billed in Godfather. He's...
Yes, he is.
Yeah, but he is, yeah. I can't remember which number he is, but he's also in the top 10 for Make It Off What You Can't Refuse.
Well, we'll double check that one, but definitely Ready for My Close-Up and May the Force are not said by the top billed actors. You got those ones right. Okay, the Next 100 Project's 77th Phil Maroney and our 222nd podcast overall. Cool Hand Luke was most definitely nominated for the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists, but it did not make it, and I'm not happy about that. Warner Brothers released the movie nearly 50 years ago on November 1st, 1967, and it was quite successful. Well, Bev, let's hear what the movie's about with your skinny.
It's the early 50s, and Paul Newman is Luke Jackson, a disaffected war vet who's starting a 2-year stint in a Florida work camp prison for damaging parking meters. His aloof attitude and unbreakable spirit make him popular with the other prisoners, but get him into trouble with the prison bosses, who have to go to extremes to get Luke under their thumb.
Or, in a nutshell, Jesus figure dies while mouthing off. Or, a bunch of white guys tidy up rural roads. And that does nutshell the movie. They spend a lot of time tidying up rural roads. All right, so the Rotten Tomatoes numbers, 100% of the critics like the movie, 47 fresh, and 95% of audiences, so outstanding scores. It's also 170th on the IMDb's Top 250. And the movie was 17th at the 1967 United States box office. The Graduate was far and away number one in 67, but that was a landmark year, and we've covered two films recently from 1967 because In Cold Blood was not that long ago. In fact, it had the same cinematographer, Conrad Hall, for both these films. Okay, I told you a while ago we had to do this movie. You had not ever seen it until recently. It's one of my favorites from this era. What did you think of one of my favorites from this era?
I'll confess that I struggled to get into it at first. The first half has very little conflict to speak of and plays more like a straightforward depiction of chain gang life. It's not bad, but it really is a very long setup before the real conflict of the film begins. But it's really worth the wait. Once this film gets into the meat of its subject matter, it is beautiful and moving and deep. I thought about it for days. It made a huge impression on me, and Paul Newman is perfect. He broke my heart.
He's one of your favorites, and now you have another reason to like him.
I don't think I've seen a Paul Newman performance that I prefer over this.
Including in The Hustler, Butch Cassidy, The Sting. Yeah. Have you seen HUD?
I have not seen
HUD. Okay, we'll do that next year. That'll be the 55th anniversary in 2008, 2018, sure. I should say. Well, I already said I'm a big fan. It's because of some things we'll talk on the podcast. I'll explain as we go along, but I do love this movie. In fact, if I had to pick my number one favorite from 67, and that's tough because Bonnie and Clyde is great and In Cold Blood's wonderful, but this is my favorite movie from that year.
Wow. Okay, well, tell me why. What do you like so much about it?
The ending is actually kind of sad. All these guys are putting their faith in a symbol. Luke is a person. They all like him. They all respect him. But he's more important to them as a symbol. And the fact that he was never real to them in some ways, because when he is broken by the bosses, one of the guys goes and finds the picture and rips it up. I mean, good God, this guy's been tortured by digging the stitch after a long day of work already. He broke. Any human being can break. But to them, he's not human, really.
Yeah, and even though he didn't ask to be their hero whatsoever, they still feel like he owes them something.
Stop feeding off me! He doesn't want to be their hero.
It's a real peel the onion movie. There's more depth the more you go, the layers of it. It's all really there. His character is such a beautifully wrought commentary on humanity.
And also, people will point out the egg scene at the end of it. He's in a Jesus pose. Okay, sure, that's the most overt image in the whole thing. But he's a Jesus character all the way through. And I guess that's what I like about it. Not that I'm some big Jesus character fan of movies, but I do like when it's done fairly subtly, and I didn't pick up on some of these things until I had seen the movie several times. I think I've probably seen it at least six times now after this time with you. But beyond just the crucifixion pose at the end of the egg scene, there's Christ imagery all the way through. First of all, Luke 1:37, his number's 37, and that passage in the Bible is, "With God, nothing is impossible." So that's a meaningful thing there too. He's got his own Judas at the end. His friend Dragline leads them to where he is in that church. He has his big confrontation at the end in a church, and it's kind of cold that they gun a guy down, this Jesus figure especially.
Well, Jesus did confront God at the end of his
life. And he's got his thing in the Garden of Gethsemane moment where he's not in the passion kind of way, where he's bleeding, praying so hard, but he has his little thing at the end. He's also talking to God more than once. It's blatant that he's talking to God when they're out in the rain. I'm just talking to myself. And then at the end, when he doesn't get an answer yet again.
And like Jesus, a big reason why people respect him and have this hero worship of him is simply because he takes all this torture. There is this weird fanaticism that people have for the passion play, right? For Passion of the Christ, right there. They're obsessed with the amount of torture that Jesus endured and pain that he endured with stoicism, and that's Luke's main thing.
The two times I can remember Luke smiling the same way, because he has that Luke smile of his, as Dragline says, but not the grin, but more that quiet satisfaction smile, is after the eggs, and then when he's been shot. So he stuffed himself with food, and maybe he could have died from that much food in an hour, and at the end when he's about to die from a gunshot wound. It's like a strange, satisfied smile that he achieves something, hurting himself in the process. Does he get off on that? Does he want to be tortured? Did this guy go through something in the war? I guess when they say war, they're talking about World War II, but it arguably could be the Korean War. But whichever war he's from, this is a guy who's been decorated with medals, yet he's out of the army without being a high-ranking military guy. So obviously he fucked up, and he was challenging the rules back then probably too, and doing all kinds of things wrong. But does he also enjoy being tortured, punished, and treated badly?
I agree. I think he's a masochist. I think that this whole movie, while it is a story, a Jesus story to say about him gaining this hero worship, he truly is just a self-destructive masochist. The movie starts with him doing an absolutely stupid crime. The cops come, he doesn't run, he just waits for them. He seems to want to get caught, he seems to want to go to prison. We don't know anything else about his life except that he's committed this dumb crime and gotten himself caught, and he can't rationalize it or explain it to anybody. He doesn't seem to care to make friends. He has lots of opportunities to kind of join in and take part, but he just ignores everybody until he's forced to take part when they start to respect him because of the boxing match. There's the first example of him just taking pain over and over. He wants to get hurt. People are begging him to lie down. They already respect you, dude. You don't need to keep getting up. But his desire for pain and his desire for self-destruction almost ironically turn him into a saint. This sainthood that I don't believe he wants at all.
He doesn't want to know.
He wants to die. At the end, he wants to die. Why does he escape the first time? Forget the third time. He only has a 2-year sentence. It doesn't seem like prison life disagrees with him that much. Yeah, he has reasons to be mad at them. They very unjustly put him in the box simply because they were like, well, you're at risk of escape because your mother died and you're going to want to go to the funeral. So until the funeral's over, we'll put you in the box.
And they guarantee he's going to try to get out of jail after that because why not?
What do you mean, why not? Why not? Because you get caught, you get time added to your sentence.
But if you're going to fuck me over, I might as well earn it, I think is what he's thinking there. I'm going to get out for sure now.
I don't know if we're really supposed to get in his head and understand all of his motivations, but I think there's a possibility that with his mother gone, his mother who, while he loved her, he disappointed her.
Yeah.
And that's very clear. She seems like a woman who tried to be a good mother and certainly tried to do right by him and loved him, but things didn't work out.
That's a
very interesting character. But he has lost whatever that motivation to live was, whether it was to redeem himself in her eyes, or maybe he just feels so guilty about anything that he could have done to make her life worse. He then goes into this hyper self-destructive mode because he just keeps escaping until death is inevitable.
We don't learn that much about him, and we certainly don't get any kind of inner life, certainly no voiceover narration or anything like that in this film. But I think that scene with his mother and his brother and his nephew is more enlightening than most people are going to give it credit for. He doesn't call her mother except for one time. Otherwise, he calls her Arletta the whole time. He's obviously not close to his brother. The brother gives him a banjo. And by the way, that's the one thing he gets from Arletta. So it's the gift of music, which is a nice thing, I suppose. But that's all he gets from her.
And what does he say when he gives her the banjo? This is so that you have nothing to come back for. As in, like, you're not welcome.
Right.
When she's gone and the farm is mine, don't come around.
So that's what I'm saying, is that he barely talks to his brother and they're not close. Obviously, there's some kind of big problem there. And even his mother, you say that she loved him. I don't know that she really did. She seems like she's an alcoholic or something really wrong with her, and she dies soon after that, obviously. It's only been a matter of weeks, I guess.
She says she loved him more than his brother. She
maybe she's lying.
That she loved his father, you know, even though he ran off on her, he made her laugh. So we know that his father's out of the picture. We know they're obviously dirt poor. They come there in that pickup truck. She's lying in the bed of a pickup truck because she's dying. She just wants to see her son one last time. Even just the image of a woman chain smoking, the way she chain smokes, there's a very working class, I don't even think does it justice, a rural working class, 1940s, 50s America. She gave me this real Ma Jode vibe.
Yeah, right.
She admits how much she loves him in spite of him, in spite of everything he did. But she also admits that he was a disappointment and a heartache to her.
He doesn't seem to hold any ill will towards her in that scene, at least. The two actors play it really well. That's Joe Van Fleet, who won an Oscar in 1955 for East of Eden. They apparently wanted Bette Davis. And Bette Davis was certainly a bigger name and probably would have killed that role just as much, if not more, than Joe Van Fleet. But hey, no criticism on Van Fleet. She was fantastic. So I guess there's no ill will towards them, and maybe I'm reading more into that than there should be. But I'm saying that it's a small scene, but such a critical one, because you also get him crying while he plays the banjo. He's left by himself. They all leave him alone. Would they do that for any of the other prisoners if they found out their mother died? But there's a great example of a Hollywood mourning scene, mourning with a U in it, where he has a couple of gentle tears, bawling his eyes out.
Manly, pretty tears.
Oh, and by the way, back to the beginning where he does cut the heads off the parking meters, I wonder if that's an homage to Rebel Without a Cause, which was the same year that she won the Oscar for East of Eden, 1955. Paul Newman maybe was going to be in that movie. They did screen test with him. It's on the DVD for Rebel Without a Cause. But in the beginning of Rebel, Jimmy Dean's thrown into jail for a stupid reason too, also very publicly drunk, and that's what sets the whole movie in motion. So I wonder if this beginning is an homage to that one, although it is based on a book. Don Pierce is his name. He wrote the book in 65. Another one, we've done so many of these movies where a book came out and then 2 years later the movie's out. Pierce co-wrote the screenplay with Frank Pearson, but we'll talk about that stuff a little later on.
He was writing about his own experiences on a chain gang.
Yeah, and he didn't like the movie, by the way. He didn't like the final product. I guess he didn't think that Newman did a great job. Maybe not so much criticizing Newman, but the way it was played, the way it was directed. Well, he co-wrote the screenplay, so maybe it was Newman he had a problem with, but he did not like the final product. And when Luke and Harry Dean Stanton is part of that original group that gets sent to jail at the same time, the captain, Strother Martin's character, says, "It's all up to you," about how to behave. But nothing is really up to us, especially in these situations of being in jail, or if you have a job, or if you have a family. There are freedoms, there are things you can do, but really in the end, especially as a prisoner, nothing's really up to you. You follow the rules, or they punish you. He makes it sound like you have choices. Well, yeah, you have two choices. That's it.
Well, one of the main themes of the film is conforming, and how Luke refuses to conform. And prison, much like the army, is almost like an extreme version of conforming. Part of that is asking permission for every single thing. Everybody wears the same clothes. Everybody does the same job. Everybody goes to bed at the same time, eats the same meals. And you do not talk back. Any form of talking back is seen as a threat to the authority. And they do a really great job. Stuart Rosenberg nails that claustrophobic energy of being watched all the time. Since we only identify with the prisoners, we feel their constant threat, the constant menace of the guards. It's tremendously effective.
Well, also in the beginning, and it's not a menacing character, but Carl, he's the floor walker, is that what he calls himself? He goes through that whole thing where he says, you do this wrong, spend a night in the box. Do this wrong, spend a night in the box. He's clearly recited this speech thousands of times before. He's got it memorized down pat. He's actually pretty likable as far as the people that are keeping these guys in jail go. He's a pretty decent guy. He's a big part of the egg scene, too.
As much as they are a menace, they don't appear to really be terrible villains. They're doing their job. And there's a line where he says, I'm just doing my job. Well, that doesn't make it right. No, it doesn't make it right. But he still has to do his job. And if he doesn't do it, someone else is going to come in and take his place. It is the system that's evil, not necessarily the people doing their job. And you could make this movie from the point of view of the captain, who doesn't really mistreat the prisoners that much until there's a threat to his authority. It's just that Luke keeps escaping, and so he has to keep increasing the punishment and make an example out of him. Otherwise, he's going to lose complete control of all of his prisoners, and there aren't enough of them to handle an uprising.
Yeah, of course. Morgan Woodward plays Godfrey, the guy with the shades, who pretty much doesn't speak. I think he has a few lines when he's not actually on camera. I was watching very closely for that, and I think the only time you ever actually hear him say anything, I wasn't even sure it was him, was when Luke is playing that he's been cowed, and then he has to get the turtle, right? The guy wants the gun. You hear one of them call for Luke and ask for the gun. I don't think that's supposed to be any of the other prison guards. But Luke Askew, who was an Easy Rider a few years later with Dennis Hopper, who's in this movie in a small role. Luke Askew has a lot of the dialogue, and maybe Morgan Woodward would have had some of that, but it went all to Luke Askew, who does a damn good job as Boss Paul, actually. I thought he's one of the more effective actors in the movie. But you're right, they're not really villains. They're mostly doing their job. And I don't know that the movie's really all that brutal against any of them either. In fact, some of the reviews talked about how this was actually a sunny portrait of this. Yeah, there's the whole thing where they have to even ask permission to take off a fucking shirt, which is a little bit nuts. Take it off here, boss, like we did in the very beginning of the podcast. And by the way, they should be very sunburned for A, having that job, and B, for taking clothes off. They should be so red and sunburned. And did you notice there's no black people whatsoever?
Well, they mentioned black people. Oh, that's not true. Oh, there's no black people in prison.
That's what I mean,
segregated prisons. You see the black kids.
Oh, that's right, isn't it? Yeah.
Taking off his. And all I could think was, oh my God, if this is really the 1950s, those kids are going to be arrested and tried as adults for aiding and abetting a prison escapee just because they're black. And there is the very telling and impactful line that I think it's Boss Paul has, where he's kind of trying to defend himself to Luke, and he says, hey, you know, I've been doing this job for 20 years, and I ain't never shot a white man. Paul Newman's performance in that moment, I rewatched that scene. I found that so interesting. You can see that he has a real moment of pause and that he's affected by what he says, because while Boss Paul truly believes, like, he delivers that line as if, hey, man, I'm a good guy. I've never killed a white man. And what he's confessing to is that he has killed men. He has killed somebody. But their attitude is such that, well, that's not a human. You don't understand. That's not a person like you. And what that says about his character, what that says about the time and place where they're in. I'm sure you could criticize. I mean, it's hard to criticize the movie for the way it treats race. It's 67, just a different time and place. But actually, it kind of seems like they address it in at least a small way.
Well, I hadn't thought about the fact that it'd be segregated with their prisons. So if that's the case, then the movie's being accurate to the times. And you're not going to see very many black people walking around. When they're out doing their job, you don't really see very many cars drive by them either. We see Joy Harmon with one of the more famous scenes in the whole movie, along with the egg scene. The second most famous scene is probably when she comes out and washes the car.
Oh, yeah.
She didn't make very many movies, and we don't know if she can act, because all she does is just play around with water and get herself covered. And I can understand why those guys are ogling her, because that scene remains so sexy many years later. Although apparently when they shot the movie, those guys weren't looking at her. They were looking at somebody else because she had to go. I don't really hear why she wasn't playing the scene.
But they cast like another hot actress to do something for them to look at so they could react. She was a cheerleader or
something. But it wasn't what we saw on screen. Which I guess is typical in movies, but it's just funny to think that they didn't actually see what we get to see later on.
Oh yeah, she is a babe. But I think she was just hired for her looks. I say that because she's just so clumsy and phony, and there's a point where she straight up looks right into the camera. Mm. She's not an actress. She's just, like, an exceptionally attractive young woman.
Yeah. But apart from her, you don't really see very many people, if anybody, when they're doing their job. It's just the guards and the prisoners. There must be some cars here and there, but I can't think of an example of them having to wait for a car to go by when they're actually working on the road.
Yeah, it's true.
And I don't know if you really shut down roads in those situations anyway. When they're blacktopping that one little stretch, of course, then you can't have people driving on that. But otherwise, I would think cars would just drive as much as they wanted to around there.
For as much as the movie is defined by the prison, there's very few reminders of what life outside prison is like and what the prisoners are missing. It has to be a choice. It would have been so easy, especially in the situation they're in as a chain gang, to incorporate elements of freedom, to give the men constant reminders, to see families, to see women, to see great cars that they would love to drive, any number of things that would make them jealous of people living on the outside. They just don't include any of those elements.
Well, the two female characters are maybe the example of that. The mother and the potential sex interest. I was going to say love interest, but sex interest. And then we see the pictures of the women that Newman sends back. The fake, as he says later on. But they don't really count. So Joy Harmon and Joe Van Fleet, maybe that's what these guys are supposed to miss. A mother figure and then a sex object or a love object even. I just mentioned the most famous scenes. Well, the other one, of course, is the egg-eating scene. One of my favorite lines in movie history. I know I don't quote you very often, but I do love when George Kennedy says, "Get mad at them damned eggs!" I don't know
why. Get mad at them?
Them damned eggs! They treat the egg scene like a boxing match, too. You can't do no more, Rock! Pauly should be training him in this. And, of course, it's one of the more humorous scenes in the whole film. There's not a lot of laughs. In their fight, when it looks like Newman's done and George Kennedy is basically saying to him, it's over, he still slugs him one more time, and that's a funny moment. But most of the comedy in the whole movie is in the egg scene, right down to the guy thumping his chest, and here he's going to pop. It's like a cantaloupe or whatever he calls it.
And it's a great way to exhibit just how much natural charisma he has. And, of course, a lot of that comes from Paul Newman being such a charismatic man that he was. The natural way that he has that smile. Everybody talks about his smile. Almost a smile. It's just this kind of bemusement that he seems to express at all times. Just his resting, bemused face.
You mean when he's done eating the eggs?
But at all times, he just has this way about him that's very charismatic. But it really comes through in that scene. He's incredibly aloof. He doesn't open up to these men. He makes no close friendships with them. But his aloofness is another part of his appeal. It makes people curious about you. He's playing hard to get, in a way.
Did you notice as soon as Luke's done eating the eggs, they bail? They all...
And they're gone. I know they just did that so they could set up the shot because they wanted him alone, lying on the bench.
I think it means something, though. Because again, this whole Jesus metaphor, he's left alone. He's been their savior, and now he's done something really cool that they're all thrilled about. Well, everybody's thrilled because they were betting against him. Some of them were. But they all leave him, and I think the idea being that you're great until we don't care anymore.
It's a little contrived, though, just because I don't think that any normal people would do that. They wouldn't leave him alone for the rest of the night. They would be curious about what it feels like to eat 50 eggs. Why didn't you say 35 eggs? You always have to say 50.
Nice round number.
And there are 50 prisoners. That is could be the reason why he chose 50 eggs.
And it was something to do, as he says. There's also the delightful scene where they do blacktop the road, which they apparently did for real. They were busting ass in that scene. The music in that one became a news theme. And there's that moment of success where, what do we do now? There's still light. Guess we're done.
And another movie would have, just to make the bosses more evil, had them give them another job to do and not just reward them for working super hard that day. And that's another example of Luke's masochism. When he starts it, it's not with the intention of everybody else ganging up and doing it with him. He just wants to push himself to the point of extreme exhaustion. And then, again, inadvertently gets all these people to follow him.
One nice thing that they do for him, they don't really do a lot for him, that's for sure. But it is nice when the little rat boy gives him a huge plate of rice. And if he doesn't eat it all, he's got to go to the box. You got to eat all your food. You don't clean your plate, you got to go to the box. But they all take a spoonful and help him out with that. It's one of the few times that they do something for him.
They also sing him spirituals while he's digging the ditch. Spirituals, okay. another Jesus thing right there. When he's suffering and they're trying to break him, so they get him to dig the ditch. They get him to put the dirt back in over and over until he's so exhausted that he finally does break. And they keep giving him beatings all the while. So he's just in agony. That's the thing that finally does him in. And this is a man that is next to impossible to break. And all the while, they're in the barracks singing spirituals, like church music to him, worship songs.
Harry Dean Stanton does a lot of singing in this movie. Newman does too by singing Plastic Jesus on the banjo, but Harry Dean Stanton sings various songs in the whole film. Luke's first breakout, did you notice this, was on the 4th of July, or at least that weekend, because they talk about it being the holiday.
Reminds me of The Great Escape.
I was just going to say that that's an important moment in that film too, because a guy tries to get away and he gets killed, and that's what gets McQueen on the side of helping them rather than just being aloof, just like Newman was. These two guys were competitive actors, I guess, with each other, more so McQueen with Newman. And Newman had more natural charm, I think. But they both had that detached way about them in some of their best roles. And McQueen's very detached in The Great Escape. His character is, and he was anyway. Apparently he was an asshole on set. But you're right, that was a key moment in that movie and a key moment in this movie, July 4th. Everything changes for the main characters in that way. If Luke didn't break out, he wouldn't be in the box, he wouldn't have the chains, and he wouldn't be more determined to break out again and again until they kill him. When he breaks out the second time? Yeah, because the third time is when he takes the truck. How did he get away while shitting when they're watching him?
He wasn't shitting.
Well, pretending to shit. The whole point is he's got to pinch off a
load. Well, they say, you're entitled to privacy, just keep shaking the bush so that we know you're
but
there.
They're watching where he is. If he's just skidding away, they're going to see a movement in the bush.
I guess. You have to use your imagination a little
bit. Well, we ask questions like that all the time in this podcast. Why are you doubting me now? And you mentioned the black kids. I do like that he enlists them to help him escape because, like you point out, black people and those kids will soon face this. Have been fucked over way more than Lucas Jackson ever has been.
Yeah, I don't think I want to see the movie that they make about what black prisoners in Florida were going through in that period of time, because I'm sure it's a lot uglier than what the white prisoners were going through.
His worst punishment in the whole film, other than being shot and killed probably, would be the Sisyphean task of digging and then filling in the ditch when he's already had a hard day's labor. And that scene is what breaks him, even says to Dragline later on. No, they broke me.
Yeah, Dragline's like, way to fake it. No, I wasn't faking it.
So he wasn't goal-breaking, but then the question becomes, was he at least planning an escape the whole time, despite the fact he was like Reek on Game of Thrones? He was broken, but was he fully broken? Obviously not, because he did get away.
It is my opinion that he was effectively committing suicide. This is a thing that people do. Cops talk about this. They call it suicide by cop, where individuals will do something that forces a cop to kill them. They commit actions that they know will result in a cop killing them. I believe Luke hates himself this much, is this self-destructive, has this little hope about his future that he simply wants to die. And when he's lamenting to God, I don't know what to do to make my life right. It just seems like nothing I do. You made me this way.
Yeah.
Here I am just failing and failing and failing at life. And I don't know what else to do because this is just the way I am. He could submit, although if he surrendered, would they have actually just taken him
back? They said they were going to kill him.
Yeah, they said, if you escape again, we'll kill you.
And when he gets shot by the Shades guy, all he's doing is repeating the line, what we've got here is a failure to communicate.
He's not sassing doing them. He's sassing them.
Well, that's true, he's sassing, but they don't have to shoot and kill him. But they said they were going to, so they lived up to their
word. Surrounded. They could take him, but they told him that they would. And they really need to make an example out of him. Although they also kind of make a saint out of him. Because like Jesus, dying and martyring himself has put him in an even higher regard with the prisoners. And that way, he can never fall off that pedestal now.
That's right.
And they'll always believe that he was faking, that he was broken. Dragline's not going to tell them. Dragline is more invested in Luke the Saint than anybody.
That's right. It's funny, too, that even as a prisoner, in this case Dragline, but somebody's got to be the top cheese as the guys in jail. So even somebody who hates the man wants to be the man.
Yeah, he's like the alpha dog of the prisoners.
One of the songs that's sung in the movie is No Grave Gonna Keep My Body Down, which is more suggestions of martyrdom because the grave is irrelevant.
And he's digging himself a grave, right. More or less.
Yeah, so it's literal, but I mean that song does apply to the fact that this isn't the end for him. He doesn't want to be that way, but it really isn't. And like I said a while ago, the happy ending is really kind of sad. But did you notice the very last shot is Luke's picture with the two women, so his arms around them, sort of cross-like position, and then as the camera pulls back and it's this crossfade between the picture and the shot of the road, the intersection of the road makes it look like he is on a cross.
It's funny that they chose that image and not, say, the image of him after having eaten the eggs. And the image of him with the two women, we know, is a fake. Is he a fake Jesus?
I think they're not going to believe that that was a fake. They're going to say that he said that because he was upset. Or they're going to pretend they didn't hear it. Just like anybody who believes in religion has to overlook some things that are pretty awful to buy into their religion. We've been watching the Scientology series with Leah Remini and the kinds of hoops people have to go through to get through that. Every religion, that's true, but that one maybe more so than most.
I think the movie is critical of the prisoners, of their hero worship, of human nature's need to lionize people, whether they want to be lionized or not, and of the things that we choose to value. What is it about Luke that's so valuable? That he can take abuse? That he constantly challenges authority? It's a strange thing that he should be the hero, even with all his reluctance. He's not really in it for the prisoners. He's in it for himself and his own self-hatred, self-destruction.
When he says the stop feeding off me line, just go out there and do it yourself, whether you break out or just do something other than...
Or just let me be. This is the way I am. This is the way I'm going to be. I'm not doing it for your benefit.
Yeah.
Why do you have to turn me into a hero?
Well, the hero of the movie, Paul Newman, playing an anti-hero yet again, he did that so well in so many movies, especially in the 60s because of The Hustler, which we covered, and HUD, which we will cover, Butch Cassidy at the end of the decade, where he's actually a very nice guy, but he is still a criminal, and then The Sting a few years later, where again, he's a criminal. He's always easy to like in movies, but he's distant and prickish in his best roles. This and HUD are great examples of that. There's not much dialogue for him in this movie, considering he's always on screen and is the top star of the whole film. I was trying to think of who could play this character if they redid the movie. I don't want them to remake the movie, but if they remade it, I think George Clooney would be an interesting choice. He certainly has the charm and the sense of humor.
And he's played cads before.
Mm-hmm.
So he has the complexity or the capacity to play someone who's potentially unlikable.
And yet likable anyway, because of that Luke smile, for one thing. That's an important part of the end of the movie, too, where Dragline's talking about how he died, and then you see the various smiles in the movie, and it's an important thing to give us a little bit more of an uplifting moment, I guess, rather than it being a complete sad ending.
There's also the scene where Luke kind of turns on Dragline when he escapes for the third time and he gets in the truck and Dragline just jumps in the truck with him.
Mm.
You learn pretty quickly that he's more of a burden to Luke. Luke doesn't want him around.
Yep.
Get out of here. I don't want you. Go off on your own. And Dragline will rationalize and say, yeah, you're right, Luke. We should totally split up. And Luke's like, no, fuck off. I don't want to be a part of this little dyad that you've created here. This isn't what I wanted. And the scene's very frustrating. It's very surprising and off-putting, but it's such an important and raw insight into the character and what I think the film's trying to say.
The Judas character, too, because he does rat out Luke as to where he is.
And not out of malice.
Yeah.
He believes them when they say that they're going to be okay.
They're reasonable men.
Yeah, he just wants to save Luke.
Or George Kennedy was, or still is. I don't know if he's even alive anymore. But anyway, he was in Airport a couple years after this. That was the one actually really set him on his way as the brawny action star. And then funny in the Naked Gun movies.
That's what I remember him from, the Naked Gun movies.
Well, that's probably true for most of that in this movie, of course, too. He's also illiterate, which I thought was an interesting part of the movie. Most of them probably are, but that's made pretty clear at one point in the movie that he can't read when Luke sends the picture and the little letter to the guys. And Kennedy promoted himself in the trade magazines in 68, it would have been for the 67 Oscars, just the way Melissa Leo did for The Fighter many years
and
later.
It worked for both of them.
Yeah, it's a little distasteful. I didn't know that he did that, but I heard that she had. I'm not so sure I would have voted for either of them. I didn't think she was that great in The Fighter. I was not a big fan of that movie anyway. And Kennedy's very good in this, but he was up against both Hackman and Pollard and Bonnie and Clyde, and I forget the other nominees at the moment. It's a good choice, I suppose, but he's the only one that won an Oscar from this movie. Strother Martin was with Newman in Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, one of my favorite little roles in that, where he plays the guy who works for the mine and the whole bingo as he spits and everything. And, of course, The Wild Bunch that same year, so a lot of great movies in a short span for him. He was in tons of other movies, but they're three of his better ones. I mentioned Dennis Hopper's in the movie in a small role. He was in four AFI movies, and he still wasn't a star, obviously, if he's got such a small role in this. But I wonder if he is a previous rebel who cracked. Was he the Luke from many years before who they broke? He got his mind right, but in the process lost his mind because he seems like he's mentally retarded.
He seems like he's stupid, though. He doesn't seem like he's insane.
Well, maybe, but I just wonder if he was supposed to represent the previous Luke that they did manage to get the mind right for. Their director, Stuart Rosenberg, who did a few other movies with Paul Newman and then the Amityville Horror in the late 70s, but this is definitely his best movie. Frank Pearson and Don Pierce wrote that screenplay. Hal Dresner was an uncredited addition to the scripting process. And as I said, Pierce didn't like the final product, but he wasn't a chain gang, so he was speaking authentically. And the producer was Gordon Carroll, who went on to work with Hill and Giler on the Alien movies. I knew I recognized that name from somewhere, so when I clicked on it, I thought, oh, yeah, Gordon Carroll. And the other big name behind the scenes, Jack Lemmon, his production company made this movie. He was going to be Luke, but then I guess he realized he wasn't right for it. Instead, he, I don't know if he hired Newman, but Newman got the job instead of him. And I like Jack Lemmon a lot, but I don't think he would have been quite right for this role.
I totally agree.
Movies 2, 3, 5, 1, we watched the DVD, which is okay. Would have liked to have seen the Blu-ray, but we didn't have it. Cinematographer, as I said earlier, was Conrad Hall, who did In Cold Blood this same year. Also, Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid and American Beauty and other Sam Mendes movies. He won 3 Oscars before he died not that long ago. The editor was Sam Osteen, who worked a lot with Mike Nichols, including on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf the year before this, and then Chinatown. So obviously working with Roman Polanski as well. And the composer who did that theme, Lalo Schifrin, who's done 115 movies. He's been working for 60 years and is still working now. He is an old man still composing music, just like John Williams. And he composed on Bullet, a Steve McQueen movie, and Amityville Horror for Stuart Rosenberg. Okay, the influences, there's quite a bit. Guns N' Roses used the failure to communicate line in two of their songs. Although I don't know those songs, but I read that online that that's true. And then Edward Norton's character in 25th Hour, the Spike Lee movie from 2002, has a Cool Hand Luke poster on his wall. The really cool one where it's Luke's face in this orangey-brown kind of design, multiple faces kind of deal. Maybe it's supposed to be a Rage Against the Machine guy with him, too. He's also going to jail. He's worried he's not going to come out of there, that he thinks he'll get killed in jail for being pretty, I guess. And I looked over and saw your notes a few minutes ago, and I have the same last two influences that you do. Shawshank Redemption and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Can't just let me say something? What?
The arc in Shawshank is very similar to this one. The new guy who barely hacks the early days, he's also very aloof and then becomes a star to everybody and successfully breaks out of prison. Well, Luke doesn't successfully stay out of prison, but he does break out of prison at least, and he stays out of prison in Shawshank. And the Cuckoo's Nest, also the similar arc where there's a hero to a group of defeated men who will look at him as always the hero, although then again maybe that's not true because they would find his dead body there when the chief had smothered him, so maybe he isn't quite the hero that he would have been. Although they're going to choose, just like these guys in Cool Hand Luke, to remember him for what he was, not what he became later on. All right, the awards and list section is pretty long. The movie won the Oscar for Supporting Actor for Kennedy, and it was nominated for Best Actor Paul Newman, but he didn't win. It was also up for the script and for that music score. By the way, not nominated for Best Picture or Best Director, which is bullshit anyway, but when you consider that Dr. Doolittle got a Best Picture nomination, that's even worse. That was a damn good year for movies, but Dr. fucking Doolittle was one of the five nominees. Cool Hand Luke was entered into the National Film Registry in 2005 along with Giant, The French Connection, and Toy Story, all AFI movies, and The Sting, which we covered as a non-AFI movie. Cool Hand Luke was 71st on the Top 100 Cheers. Its Wonderful Life was number one on that list. It was 30th on the pretty side of the Top 100 Heroes and Villains. Atticus Finch was the number one hero. Is he really a hero?
Of course he's a hero.
Anti-hero.
Oh, Luke, I thought you meant Atticus Finch for a second. I'm like, what planet are you on? I sided with the KKK in that movie. Is Luke a hero? Of course Luke's a hero, but his complexity makes him that much more interesting.
He's an anti-hero.
He's a tragic hero. Mm-hmm. He's beyond an anti-hero. He's a reluctant hero and never changes, never comes around in that Hollywood fashion, which is what makes the film
special.
That's
true. He doesn't really have an arc. I mentioned the movies, mm-hmm. Shawshank and Cuckoo's Nest have similar arcs, but his character doesn't really have one.
A lot of Hollywood movies, in that moment when he's trying to tell Dragline to go away, that would be instead the moment where the hero comes around and does the right thing and lives up to the hero persona that everybody around him has given him. And then they just come through, the music swells, and everybody's satisfied by how our hero has grown and come to accept his role. No, the opposite happens. But I guess the list is honoring heroes not for being necessarily successful or good at being heroes. I mean, Atticus Finch, the number one hero, he fails. So there is something to be said for heroes that fail or heroes that don't want to be there. I'm glad that they chose him as a hero. I think it's meaty for discussion, if nothing else.
Thelma and Louise are also on the heroes list, and that's also a debatable choice.
Oh yeah, I'm sure that you could go through that list and pick apart every single choice they make as heroes and villains.
And we said at the top the movie was 11th on the top 100 quotes. Frankly, my dear, don't give a damn was number one quote, which has always rankled me. That is not the greatest quote in the history of movies. I wouldn't even put it in the top 100, to be honest. And Cool Hand Luke was nominated for the top 100 thrills. Is it really heart-pounding?
Nope.
Okay, I don't think so either. And the top 25 music scores didn't make either one of those lists.
I did not like the score. Found it kind of annoying. It reminded
typical
me of
60s
Midnight
music.
Cowboy. Typical 60s, it doesn't suit my taste.
I've been a fan of a lot of music we've covered
it's
in
true.
These movies.
True, I'm very picky about score.
All right, well then, final parting thoughts on Cool Hand Luke, our final movie of September.
Well, if we haven't convinced you to love this film yet, Paul Newman is basically allergic to shirts in this movie, and I am here for that. I mean, that gives it 5 stars, because goddamn, he looks great in this movie, better than that woman washing the car, and he's in the whole thing beginning to end. So there's that, too. I failed to add that Paul Newman is rather easy on the eyes.
He's beautiful. He was only 41, I guess, when they shot this movie. Not only, but he was
still
fairly young.
Shape. I don't think you need to be attracted to men to admit that he is just a very attractive person.
He's a beautiful man, yeah. You like Redford, too. Also a great-looking guy in this era. Well, you would say even now, wouldn't you? Even though he's 80-something years old.
I still have it for him.
Well, I'm a huge fan of Cool Hand Luke. I already said that more than once, and I couldn't really nutshell it very well before, but what I can say is it's a very rewatchable movie, and even though Bonnie and Clyde is certainly right there with it, I would rather watch this and The Graduates, the movie that people love from that year, In the Heat of the Night, In Cold Blood, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, all were AFI movies, or at least honored in some kind of way by us or the AFI, whatever. All noteworthy films in their own ways. Not Dr. Doolittle, though. But Cool Hand Luke is the one I would want to watch the most. If somebody said you can only keep one movie from 67 on your shelf, it'd be tough, but I'd have to go with this over Bonnie and Clyde.
Well, luckily, we share a shelf, and then I could choose Bonnie and Clyde, because that would be my number one movie from 67.
Great choice, too. All right, next week we'll enter Scary Movie Month and chat about our first of four horror shows. Number one will be a flick that isn't even a year old yet. Jordan Peele's social commentary and Fright Fest. Get out! Get out of here! Wait, that's another movie. That's There Will Be Blood. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for Get Out. What is the highest ever grossing movie when adjusted for inflation that was directed by a black man?
So for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast about Get Out. And in the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. We've covered over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 2007 list of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. And while you're there, rate us, review us. We're both on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we'd like to thank Sparkplug Coffee.
Amen, Plastic Jesus. Amen.
And